Good morning, and thank you for joining me on the Path to Liberty. I'm Michael Bolden with the 10th Amendment Center, and this is the show for Wednesday, March 15th, 2023. And there are, so far, four primary state-level approaches to passing a Second Amendment Preservation Act, Protection Act, whatever you want to call it. Three of them are good, each of them have their pros and cons, and one of them is absolutely awful and worthless. Unfortunately, the one that's awful is the one that gets replicated the most. I'm going to give you an overview of each here today, plus a little insight on the legal basis behind them and the effectiveness of the three good ones. And just to start that out, I should point out that last week, Wednesday, if you have not checked out this episode, I did my longest episode ever, I think, longest live stream ever, about an hour or so, covering in some detail the recent federal district court opinion against the Missouri Second Amendment Preservation Act, the TLDW Too Long Didn't Watch. I think it's highly likely that most of the opinion gets overturned based on standing precedent. But at this point, there's no way to know. We're basically at the mercy of the federal courts. And that fact is actually part of the pros and cons of the Missouri Second Amendment Preservation Act, the fact that it is in court and we're having to wait to see how that plays out. Anyway, so here's what we tweeted. There are four styles of Second Amendment Preservation Acts. We tweeted this. I guess I'll give it a little retweet from my own account. Missouri is the strongest by far. It's challenged in federal court on appeal. Montana is pretty creative and is currently restricting enforcement of the upcoming pistol brace ban. I'm not sure if that's supposedly implemented already or not. Arizona is the most straightforward. We're not certain of the results on the ground, but we got to keep an eye out on that. And then there's the Wyoming approach, which we see as garbage. A quick overview first, let's look at Missouri. This was signed in law in 2021. It was filed by Representative Jared Taylor and at the time, State Senator Eric Burleson. It had been an eight-year process to get it into law and passed, and it bans any entity or person, including any public officer or employee of the state. So people working for the state and its political subdivisions are banned from enforcing any past, present, or future federal acts, laws, executive orders, administrative orders, court orders, rules, regulations, statutes, and ordinances that infringe on the right to keep and bear arms. In my view, it's all of them, but anyways, the law specifically includes a list of federal acts that are considered as infringements on the people's right to keep and bear arms as, quote, guaranteed by Amendment 2 of the Constitution of the United States and Article 1, Section 23 of the Constitution of Missouri. I do like how they put some focus on the state constitution because everyone ignores that. Then it goes on to expressly ban state and local law enforcement from participating in those federal acts, which include, but are not limited to, taxes and fees on firearms, firearms accessories, ammunition, registration and tracking schemes, and I'm just kind of blasting through a general overview. Any act forbidding the possession, ownership, or use or transfer, or any act ordering the confiscation, and this is regarding firearms, firearm accessories, or ammunition. So law enforcement agencies from there are actually subject to penalties, to fines. So if they employ somebody who they know was in violation of this act, that maybe participated in a federal state joint task force, because once they're on a federal task force, the state loses complete control over them. And that's a big part of the problem that we face when it comes to the war on your natural right of self-defense. Two of the ways that they get around, do end runs around state constitutions, state restrictions on activity, is they just make deals directly between the ATF or the DEA. Heavily, the war on your right to self-defense is part of the so-called war on drugs. So it's unfortunate that so many people who support one or the other don't realize that they're so well interconnected. I should do an episode on that at some point. But what they do is they deputize local law enforcement agencies under MOUs or MOA, Memorandum of Understanding or Agreement. And once they're working with a federal task force, the ATF or the DEA, they're deputized as federal officials, and then the states are not allowed to tell those federal officials what to do. So the creative approach that we did not come up with, but I think is pretty awesome, is that they're saying, well, if you choose to be on part of these task forces, we're not going to continue hiring you. So the state still does have total control over what its political subdivisions will do for its hiring decisions. So there are penalties for agencies that continue to hire these people for each incident. What are they up to? or not less than $50,000 for each employee. And because of that, on a big picture overview, we are seeing that Missouri is banning state and local law enforcement of federal gun control that it sees, that the state sees as a violation of the Constitution. Then it uses these penalty clauses on those agencies to ensure compliance. I've actually been surprised at how well the penalty provisions have worked. They're so well crafted, but unfortunately, they are in. This is one of the subjects of the court case. Now we're at the mercy of the federal courts, but in the time that it went into effect in the middle of 2021 till now, the state, and they are still in effect because that opinion by the district court was immediately appealed and it is still in force, so that was, it's kind of just in process. But once, because of these penalty provisions, a bunch of law enforcement agencies around the state just completely severed relationships with ATF joint task forces. And I'm like, man, that is incredible. That's exactly what we want the state to do, to stop helping the ATF. So, but this is the big motivation behind the DOJ lawsuit. I covered that in the other episode, and I've covered this since 2021, the ATF, the DOJ has been complaining heavily that opting out, that ending these relationships is severely impacting their ability to enforce federal gun control. And that's awesome. But again, this is why it's in federal court. This is part of it. Two main reasons. One, the state is determining stuff to be unconstitutional and federal judges are like, whoa, only we can do that. And so therefore, the whole thing is unconstitutional. Even though we still agree that you can ban your law enforcement officers from participating in federal enforcement. It just, you used illegal words and you're not allowed to say it the way that you said. That's basically what it's getting down to. And then two, they're claiming that enforcement provisions, the penalties on the law enforcement agencies are actually violating another legal doctrine of intergovernmental immunity. I'm not going to get any details of that. It's a little boring. But short version is, I think the judge is wrong. I think it's very likely that the judge's opinion will be overturned through the process. But I can say the judge is wrong all I want. And ultimately, it is possible if one kind of establishment judge has this view, there are others out there that have this kind of view. And whether it's politically motivated or they're just dumb or, well, they're reading into the law wrong, it doesn't matter. It's still possible that other judges will agree. So one of the most effective parts of the Missouri Second Amendment Preservation Act is also one of the biggest cons. The fact that it actually is resulting in being in court and now we have to weigh out. So, the other thing that I do want to mention is the fact that Missouri is using this approach of referring to certain federal acts as unconstitutional. The judge went nuts on that. They didn't like that at all. I'm assuming that this is more about the jealousy of the federal courts not wanting anyone to have an opinion about anything without their approval. But keep in mind, states don't need to refer to something as unconstitutional to opt out of enforcement. They can stop helping the federal government enforce any federal act or regulatory program for any reason they want. There is nothing in the Constitution that requires them to participate in EPA regulations or healthcare regulations or CDC mandates or anything. Federal gun control, federal plant prohibition. They can stop if it's raining out like it is here, or if it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday, or they just don't like it. They don't even need a reason at all. And the primary reasons that SAPA, Missouri Second Amendment Preservation Act, lost its first round in court are these things. It's the court saying, this is our job. You don't get to make this call and you can't penalize anybody. Again, I think they're going to lose, but we don't necessarily want to have to wait on permission from the federal court. So on the one hand, Missouri's act is proving to be very, very effective. But on the other hand, it's a little complex in its approach, and some of the language in the act leaves the fate of it to the federal courts. Again, that's kind of negative. And that brings me to Arizona, which completely avoids all the complexity, all the legal issues. And there is no one trying to sue them because it is so straightforward. This also passed in 2021. It bans the state and all its political subdivisions, localities, local governments, counties. These are all political subdivisions of the state, from using, quote, any personnel or financial resources to enforce, administer, or cooperate with any act, law, treaty, order, rule, or regulation of the United States government that is inconsistent with any law of the state of Arizona regarding the regulation of firearms. So Arizona is basically saying, look, let's put the way that things are supposed to be. The federal government is an agent of the people of the states, and federal gun control, well, we just aren't going to recognize that. It's not that they're not recognizing. They're just saying, you figure out how to do it. And that's actually a pretty smart thought, because the federal government, the ATF, and I'll get into this in a little bit, does not have the employee or resources, does not have the person power or resources to enforce all this stuff on its own. And it doesn't even have the resources to enforce with all the help. So the less help they get, the more effective the people can be in nullifying this in practice and effect. So Arizona is basically saying, if it's not a state law, state law enforcement isn't going to do it. Now, that doesn't mean all the state gun control that's on the books in Arizona. It's less than, of course, here in California and many other places. That doesn't mean any of that is good as well. But it's an important strategy. It does shift the focus and attention. And I'm going to link to this in the show notes. I'll mention that in just a moment again. It shifts the focus and attention to any remaining gun control measures on the books in state law. It's so straightforward. Federal is federal, state is state. We're not going to help with just purely federal. And if we want to stop helping with additional federal stuff that's also on the books on the state level, we'll just have to start repealing state gun control measures. And it focuses things more inward. This is very pure 10th Amendment in its strategy. So it also encourages activists to work in future legislative sessions to repeal those state-level gun control measures as a follow-up. Each state-level gun control repeal then represents a 1-2 punch. It not only ends state enforcement of a state restriction on your natural right of self-defense, your natural right to keep and bear arms, but it auto-bans forever, unless they somehow repeal this, forever. Anytime they repeal something in state law, they also ban enforcement on a state and local level of any analogous or consistent federal act at the same time. So I think this is my favorite strategic approach. I think it has the greatest long-term potential because it shifts the focus away from the federal government and especially the federal courts. It focuses the effort inwards on a more decentralized strategic approach. Now, there's a but, and for those of you who like that, there are no penalty provisions in the Arizona law, and they actually went out of their way to say, look, there's always so much opposition from law enforcement groups as soon as you try to penalize them for doing the wrong thing, which is unfortunate because they take an oath to the Constitution for the United States and the Constitution for their state, but they are the greatest opposition on this stuff. And in some places like Arizona, where there is a very thick blue line, I don't know if that actually works as far as a phrase, but you know what I mean. When there's a very strong contingent of the people who would support this kind of legislation that will only do what the law enforcement lobby groups say is okay, or they won't go too far against them. When law enforcement lobby groups say, well, if you try to penalize us, we're going to lobby against this, and then the bill's going to die. So we take a single step there, and I'm going to get to Thomas Jefferson on that in a moment. It has kept Arizona completely out of federal court. And I think there's almost no chance that Arizona will be taken to federal court over this. There's too much federal court precedent that says we're not going to touch this type of thing. But we have not seen the same high profile separation in the news between Arizona law enforcement agencies and the ATF as we have in Missouri. So in short, Arizona possibly, and maybe I'm just missing this. I've been looking on and on for the last couple of years. I'm not finding it. I saw Tim Martin out there in the live chat. Maybe, Tim, you know of something that I'm not aware of. But we're not seeing this big, high-profile, this law enforcement agency is not going to participate in this task force. So it's possible that it's happening. It's possible. We just can't track it as easily. We're going to have to keep a closer eye on it. So it's possible it has less short-term impact. But I think it, again, has more potential in the long run because the whole shift of focus goes to the state level, and it's a very easy approach to add the penalties as needed in the future to remove more state-level gun control and address federal gun control at the state same time in the long run. But we don't know how effective it is so far, and it may require some effort to add these types of penalty provisions. Now, our model legislation is actually a mix between Arizona and Missouri. we basically take the Arizona-style approach and just saying, hey, if it's inconsistent with the laws of the state, if it does not exist under the laws of the state, state and local law enforcement can't use any personnel, money, resources, can't provide material aid or support to the enforcement, assist in the enforcement, or implementation of any federal gun control measures, whether it's by executive order, agency, or it doesn't matter where it comes from. But then there are also penalty provisions similar to the Missouri one, where it says if they employ people who violate this, we're going to they're going to get fined, they're going to lose state funds, etc. We actually got that concept on that approach in our model legislation from former Attorney General and now current Governor Greg Abbott, who actually included that in an early version of a Texas measure that did not get passed. He did not get the support he needed at that time. I wish he would get on board with that again instead of some of the garbage that they've passed there in recent years, but that's a side note. I should mention that all the things that I'm mentioning here today, you're going to find over in a blog post. I publish a blog post about 1 to 2 hours after each live stream is done. And there's a show notes section where you can find all the stuff that I'm mentioning. So you can read the articles, learn about the legislation, find other episodes, etc. I will link to that all over at 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. And while I'm here making those comments, I should take a quick moment and say hello to everyone out in the live chat. I appreciate you guys being here. There's Tim Martin, as I mentioned before, from Arizona. Good to see you, buddy. Israel in Colorado. Brent in Missouri. Clay Kent. Sharon. Alan Hughes. There's the Salt Lakers. Mad Mom. Cowboy Roy Rogers. John. Liberty Revolutionary. There's a big contingent in Missouri. I really appreciate you guys. I know you're working very hard to advance liberty there. We got a really good group of people working there as well. Tim Martin says Arizona Senate Bill 1109 amends Arizona's definition of prohibited weapon to no longer include suppressors. Oh, I wasn't aware of that. Thanks for the heads up. So this is part of the process that I'm referring to with Arizona. So if they're saying we're not going to help enforce federal gun control measures that don't exist under similarly in state law, if they decriminalize or remove suppressors from any restriction under state law, then they are no longer allowed to help enforce federal regulations or restrictions on sound suppressors. They call them silencers, but that's a propaganda term. They're really sound suppressors. That's good to know. I'll have to add that to our tracking. I appreciate your heads up on that, Tim. But that's exactly what's supposed to happen, and that's really good news. Anyways, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty is where you're going to find links to all the stuff that I'm talking about. Now, so number three on this list is also in many ways my favorite. It's super creative in how they're doing this. It also was signed into law in 2021. It bans enforcement of any federal law, executive order, rule, or regulation that is enacted, adopted, or becomes effective on or after January 21st, 2021, or a new and more restrictive interpretation of an existing law that already was on the books at that time that infringes upon, calls in question, prohibits, restricts, requires individual licensor for registration, purchase, ownership, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, anything new passed by Congress and signed into law from January 1st, 2021 on, or any new regulation. And this was really smart strategy because they're like, well, it'd be easy for them to find the wiggle room to say, well, this is all this new regulation from the ATF. This isn't a new law. This is just giving us an update on an interpretation of something that's been on the books since 1968. So this was a way of addressing new regulations by executive order. Now, they tried to go much broader with Montana House Bill 258. But law enforcement, again, they lobbied against it aggressively, and they actually got the bill killed on the first try in the Senate Judiciary or House Judiciary Committee that year, I believe it was. It voted down. It was not even close vote. So instead of just letting the bill die, they narrowed it in scope to that particular date. And people were telling me at the time, oh, are you kidding me? That's not going to do anything. What's the point? You're saying that all the old gun control is okay? Well, no, they tried to ban the state from enforcing all the old gun control as well. They weren't able to do that. And rather than getting nothing, they're like, well, let's get this line in the sand because we know the feds are always going to try passing more gun control measures or giving us new regulations that didn't exist before, as the text of the language of the law says. They're pretty smart about this, and that reduced the law enforcement opposition. Maybe they weren't smart enough to see what Gary Marbit and company were doing there in Montana, but they definitely got the line in the sand, so it's not dead. And I think this is really following Thomas Jefferson's approach, as I've mentioned many times, his 1790 letter to the Reverend Charles Clay. He said, "The ground of liberty is to be gained by inches. We must be contented to secure what we can get from time to time and eternally press forward for what is yet to get." So on Montana, they secured what they could get from time to time. The question is, will they eternally press forward for what is yet to get? Because all they need to do is, well, just change that date of January 21st, 2021. But like Arizona, because this is so straightforward, they're just banning the state from helping enforce. Montana is out of federal court. They're not in federal court. I think in the long run, they will not get into federal court. I mean, they're being so obvious about this that the Montana governor, just in the last few weeks, last month actually, put out a tweet that said, "Our right to keep and bear arms is integral to Montana's and our nation's rich heritage. That's why we prohibited the enforcement of federal gun bans in Montana, like the new ATF pistol brace rule." And he sent a letter to the AG, Merrick Garland, and said, "Look, you may have this new pistol brace rule coming in, but the state of Montana is not going to help you. So you can be brazen about this because there is no legal language in there that is open as an attack vector to take them to court." No one's even trying. I think it's very, very unlikely that it'll happen. And I think in many ways, the idea of staying out of the federal courts is better. Now, if Missouri wins, then yes, of course, it'll be a green light for everyone to just copy the Missouri legislation word for word, anything that gets approved by the federal courts, and just roll with it. And to me, that will also be positive. But in the interim, in the meantime, I think waiting on the federal courts is the wrong choice, and we can probably go with approaches that don't have to deal with that. Now, Montana's, like Arizona's, also leaves a lot of room for improvement in the long run. As I mentioned, it has this date that they're not going to enforce federal gun control measures, new ones, or new interpretations or regulations of old ones as of the January of 2021. Well, all they need to do to expand this legislation in a future session is change that date. Just one simple text in the amendment to change the date to, let's say, January 1st, 2018. Or 1988, or 1968, or 1934. Again, this is step by step, as Thomas Jefferson told us to do, and eternally press forward for what is yet to get. I like the Montana approach. I think the language in the text is very sound. Of course, I'm going to link to all of the reports on these. You can find the exact legislation and copy it and use it for your state, whatever you think is best in your state. Today in Kentucky, they're voting maybe a final vote on a bill that's very similar to the Montana legislation to address stuff retroactive to January 2021, which will, of course, address the lower third and the pistol brace rule and whatever new garbage they're throwing at us in the next few months, years, etc. Again, all three of these are very good. All three of them have their challenges. They don't do as much as we want them to do in some cases. We don't know how effective they are in some cases. We have to keep an eye on it. They land in court in some cases. So there's always a pro and con in how we address this. I don't think there is a perfect solution, at least not in this environment. And that brings me to the last one, which is the bad one. And that's the Wyoming style. Now, it's not just Wyoming. There's a bunch of other states that are doing this. And unfortunately, like I mentioned at the beginning, this is the most common. This was a Senate bill, or SF-102. I think this was passed in 2022, so just last year. It includes, and this is from Mike Meharry's report on this, it includes a number of sleight-of-hand legislative tricks to make it look like a ban on state and local enforcement of federal gun control. But a quick, close look at the text quickly reveals the measure is all bark and no bite. Now, if you want to learn specifically how they scammed people in Wyoming with this law, I'm going to link to this report, just like I'm linking to everything else, in the show notes, 10thamendmentcenter.com/path to liberty. But basically what Wyoming is doing, they couldn't get past the stronger version, or they were unwilling to really try for it. I think there was some of an effort, but there was aggressive law enforcement lobbying against it. So rather than maybe going with a different approach like they did in Montana, they kept pushing with the more aggressive approach. And then instead of getting that, you found the establishment team going with the law enforcement lobby group approved approach. And really what happens in these situations, whether it's Wyoming or West Virginia or Arkansas or Oklahoma or now Utah or many other states which we're seeing these pass in, basically the groups that are lobbying against the effective version of a Second Amendment Preservation Act are the ones that are really influential in drafting the garbage ones, like what happened in Wyoming. You get all their support, you get their input on the text of the language, and basically you end up with so many loopholes and exceptions to a ban on enforcement that the only thing it really ends up protecting in practice is the ATF and all of the statutes that are currently on the books, except maybe 1%. And again, I guess I would take the 1% as a positive if it wasn't sold as something larger. If it was just being sold to the public as, well, this is a 1% step forward instead of a protection of the Second Amendment, then I think it could actually be a positive. We could look at this as a very narrow win in Wyoming that stops enforcement of federal gun control maybe 1 out of 1,000 times, if they even do it that often, maybe 1 out of 100. And 1 out of 100 is better than 0 out of 100. But if the public thinks it's much more than what it is, then going back to the well to try to improve it becomes almost impossible. Again, we've seen this type of thing passed into law in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee, and it's on the governor's desk in Utah as well. So the legal and constitutional basis of the good ones, and I guess even the bad one, but the bad one doesn't really do anything, goes all the way back to James Madison in Federalist Number 46, where he gave us a four-step approach on how to defeat federal programs without waiting for the federal government to magically end its own programs, which never happens. This should be obvious to by now. And he said a pillar of this is this: refuse to cooperate with officers of the Union. He said a refusal to cooperate with officers of the Union. That's James Madison, father of the Constitution, telling states and individuals to refuse to cooperate. Now, oddly enough, and again, we don't want to have to wait for the Supreme Court, but unfortunately, man, politicians sure love deferring to someone else to say, I've got permission to do this. It's very unfortunate. But oddly enough, the Supreme Court backed up James Madison's view over and over and over in a series of cases from 1842, Prigg versus Pennsylvania, all the way through 2018. And then if you're counting district and appeals courts and all that, then even more recent as well. And this is something called the anti-commandeering doctrine. And here from the most recent Supreme Court opinion on this, Murphy versus NCAA in 2018, Samuel Alito wrote, "The anti-commandeering doctrine may sound arcane, but it is simply the expression of a fundamental structural decision incorporated into the Constitution, the decision to withhold from Congress the power to issue orders directly to the states. Conspicuously absent from the list of powers given to Congress, delegated, not given, is the power to issue direct orders to the governments of the states. The anti-commandeering doctrine simply represents the recognition of this limit on congressional authority." So the federal government was not delegated the power to tell state governments what they can and cannot do. Ultimately, even if they pass something that is in some level of conflict with federal law. Again, this is very effective if used on a regular basis. And Alexander Hamilton, in Federalist Number 16, I'm not a big Hamilton lover, for those of you who know, especially if you follow me on Twitter. It says Hamilton hater in my Twitter profile. Well, we know the ATF can't get the job done on its own. And Alexander Hamilton warned us that this would happen, as if it was a bad thing. Of course, in Federalist 16, this was a complaint, but it was a recognition of an important truth. He specifically said, if the interposition of the state legislatures be necessary to give effect to a measure of the Union, they have only not to act or to act evasively, and the measure is defeated. So if the federal government is relying on the states to help implement or enforce or effectuate a federal act or a regulatory program, Hamilton understood that all the states have to do is just say, we're out of here. We're not involved. You figure out how to do it. And that's exactly how it plays out today. The ATF, we know for years, they keep trying to increase the size of their budget. Their personnel basically stays around 5,100 or so. About a third of them are in administration. They're probably using fax machines still. I don't know, rotary dial phones. But with that manpower size, around 3,500 enforcement officers, with the help of every state in the country, minus these three, and not in every situation, because those three still provide help in many situations, not as many as they did before, they're still only able to close around 10,000 cases per year with state and local law enforcement assistance. Now, to me, because I believe that all gun control, state, local, and federal, is a violation of your natural right of self-defense, your right to keep and bear arms that you have as a birthright, not as a gift from government, not as a permission slip because there's an amendment in the Constitution, none of that stuff. But I believe they're all a violation, so I think that those 10,000 is 10,000 too many. But think of it like this. Let's say there were 10 or 11 or 12 million undocumented pistol braces or short-barreled rifles in violation of the NFA. There's no way the feds can do anything about it unless they get tons of help. And even when they do get tons of help, let's say they're max, let's say they can really squeeze out the enforcement numbers to 20,000. 20,000, doubling their impact, tripling, 10 times, if they 10x their impact, which isn't going to happen anytime soon, if they were able to do that, 100,000 versus 13 million or 10 million, they've definitely lost over and over and over. Now, more important than all this, and I think that's what I'm getting to at this point here, more important than all this discussion about which approach the states should use to stop enforcing federal gun control measures, or whether they should only enforce the new ones or the old ones, or they should have exceptions, etc., all the legal language, more important than all of this strategy is it's ultimately up to the people. It's ultimately up to the people and their willingness to exercise their rights, whether the government wants them to or not. If everyone out there complies with a federal ban, let's say everyone who's told that they can no longer have a pistol brace based on the rules and the factoring criteria and all the garbage that they put together to make it difficult so they can still bust people who are trying to comply, or the forms, the 4453 or whatever, the one that shouldn't exist. Let's say if everyone complies with that, and then all of the states say, we're not going to help enforce it, there's nothing to enforce. And that's really what it gets down to. The ultimate solution comes to the people. The people are supposed to resist, as James Iredell told us, when the government usurps power, or as James Madison said there in Federalist 46, refuse to cooperate with officers of the Union. And I think that brings me to a couple of important quotes that I want to leave you guys with from the great James Otis Jr., who said, "So long as people will submit to arbitrary measures, so long will they find masters." So as long as the people continue to submit, they're going to have people who to lord over them, and they will continue to have those masters over them, not just on the right to keep and bear arms, but on pretty much everything. Since every time you submit, you establish the precedent for them to pass more. Here's Otis again. He said, "There is nothing that will destroy liberty more than a prevailing opinion that it is better tamely to submit than nobly assert and vindicate our privileges." Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy and it's not going to come quick. But ultimately, as Samuel Adams told us, all might be free if they valued freedom and defended it as they ought. I'll take a look over in the live chat a little bit later today. I see Vincent over in Tampa, some back and forth with Liberty Revolutionary. Patrick Leisner is asking about Florida. The only legislation I've seen, Florida has been aggressively against this type of legislation for many years. Unfortunately, the NRA affiliate there is stronger than in many places, and a lot of people think, why would that be a problem? But the NRA hates this type of 10th Amendment legislation. They've lobbied against it everywhere we try it, or they slyly stay neutral and tell people how bad the legislation is, or badly written it is, for example, which gives the kind of more establishment politicians all the excuses they need to be like, well, let's just hold back on passing this. We don't need to have a committee hearing on this until we get the NRA on board. And the NRA has been a huge roadblock, unfortunately. Does the Missouri law have loopholes? I think the biggest loophole in the Missouri law is that some of the language has allowed it to land in federal court. My argument has always been that it's better to stay out of federal court. Even now, Missouri is actually pushing the envelope. So if they win, then this actually moves the whole effort forward in other states. If they lose, then, well, it's easy to do an end run around what the judge has had to say about it. But I don't like, my personal strategy is to avoid the federal courts. This is what we advise here at TAC all the time. We'll be very grateful for a win in Missouri. I love the people that have been working on this for so many years, and they are helping everyone advance. Even if they lose, they're still helping us because now we find the parameters that we can give a green light, and we'll find a lot more support from people who've been kind of wimping out and saying, well, we got to wait and see how this plays out. Well, now we did, and here's the boundaries that we have. Let's roll with it. I don't think there's really tons of loopholes. There is some opening, probably. I don't know. The penalty provisions are really, really smart. There's probably some loophole in there about letting them help enforce federal drug laws. That's just unfortunate. That's really how it always ends up in the red states. But we can tighten that up over time, I think, depending on how this plays out. Anyways, I'll look over at some of the comments and questions a little bit later today or tomorrow. I get lots of ideas for future episodes. But you know what? If you want to help us get this kind of information out to more people and get more successes, more wins on the board, nothing helps us get this job done more than the financial faith and support of our members. You can join us for as little as $2 a month. That dirty government fiat, they are devaluing it more and more every single day, the printing, the spending. But you know what? Throw it our way. We'll use it to take a stand for the Constitution and liberty, whether the empire wants us to or not. Again, that's 10thamendmentcenter.com/members. Jim Knowlton says, just got my annual renewal done last night. I am very grateful for that, Jim. Really appreciate you supporting us for all these years. Thank you so much. And I know there's a bunch of other people there out there that are members. I see, oh, we got a lifetime member, a couple of monthly members. I'm so grateful. And even if you're not able to, and I know it's financially difficult right now for a lot of people, if you're not able to, just help us spread the word. Smash the like button. Help trigger these algorithms. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Leave a comment. You don't have to contribute financially. We're going to continue doing this work. Don't feel any pressure. I'm just saying, if you think you've got a couple extra bucks and you like what we're doing and you want to support us, 10thamendmentcenter.com/members is the place to get that done. Again, I appreciate you spending some time with me today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you learned something. And I hope to see you next time here on The Path to Liberty.